postdoc here at the Perimeter Institute, and I will be teaching this class of a review of condensed matter, and so we'll be together for the next 3 weeks. So this class is about some fundamental questions in statistical mechanics and in modern condensed matter theory. So the questions that we have in mind is, what is exactly the what does exactly mean to have a phase? So for a very long time, it was thought that the notion of a phase was identical with the notion of symmetry. Indeed, symmetry, as you know, is one of the most important concepts in physics. And in theoretical condensed matter, it was thought to be pretty much the only important concept. So different materials were pretty much distinguished by different symmetry properties. And that was it. So this was the case until 1980, basically, when the fractional quantum of liquids were found. And they can, so fractional quantum of liquids have completely different properties depending on the value of the magnetic field. So fractional quantum of liquid is a two-dimensional electron gas at very small temperature of some millikelvin, and with a very large, like 20 Tesla, transverse magnetic field. So the point is that different phases of the system are actually not distinguished by any symmetry. So the model of symmetry and symmetry breaking went to crisis at that point, and people were forced to think about new concepts that would go beyond this model. So this is one of the topics that we will be dealing with. The topic is, what is more generally the concept that distinguishes the different phases? The second question that we will be concerned with is, are quantum effects important or not? And if yes, to what extent? So also, this is an important question. And let's say that recently, that there has been a lot of progress on the understanding of quantum phases. And it has been seen that quantum phases are much richer than classical phases. And in fact, they possess different new ways of obtaining an order that cannot be described by the usual notions like symmetry and symmetry breaking. The third question is, so if we have materials or models that can be described by some quantum properties that go beyond this paradigm, what are they good for? So it is just some mathematical or physical curiosity just for the sake of complete classification, or they have some properties that make them really, really appealing also for applications. So this is indeed the case. And so recently, there has been a lot of interest for two classes of these materials. One of these classes are topological insulators that promise to be a new route to obtain conductors without dissipation, and we will not be dealing with this. The other class of materials is topologically ordered materials, and the interest in these materials is because not only for the theoretical reasons, because they are completely new with respect to ordinary materials, but for applications, they are important because they problem is to be the right material with which one can build a quantum computer. So this is the reason why this is important. So today we will review some basic notions of statistical mechanics, and I will focus on a few of those aspects of statistical mechanics that we will be insisting a lot during the next days. But probably most of what I'm saying today is already known to you, but nevertheless, I need to review it so that I am sure that the important aspects are covered. Okay. So first of all, we would like to understand what is a phase. So we know that in statistical mechanics, the fundamental object is the free energy that is defined in this way, where T is the temperature and Z is the partition function. And the partition function Z, of course, is the trace of e to the minus beta h. So beta is the inverse temperature, and h is the Hamiltonian of the system. So, and what does a trace mean? So trace here means that we are summing on the allowed degrees of freedom. So these are the two fundamental objects. So what are the allowed degrees of freedom? So we have the notion of phase space. So the phase space is the set that contains all the possible configurations of the degrees of freedom of your system. And in particular, omega is a region in the phase space. Okay? So we might define a Hamiltonian over this region. So we will call it H of omega. And also we need a measure on omega that we will call V of omega. And so if this volume has a boundary, the surface that includes this volume will be called S of omega. Okay, so in classical statistical mechanics, the definition of this measure is already very, very problematic. It's a non-trivial thing. In fact, there is no natural way to associate a measure in the phase space. In quantum mechanics, this is much easier because quantum mechanics has some natural cell structure. So it is easy to know how to compute volumes in the phase space. So we will pretend that we know what is V of omega, but let me give you a simple example which we really know what it is. So this is the case in which our system is on a lattice. So for instance, we have some square lattice in two dimensions, and we have our degrees of freedom on the nodes of this lattice. And then in this case, the volume of this region omega is simply the number of these sites. So whenever I have some cell structure for my system, it's easy to introduce a measure. So in general, we will be concerned with lattice, hypercubic lattice in arbitrary dimension. And in this case, we will have a linear size of the system L. And then we will have some dimensionality of the system. So in this case, D is equal to. And this volume, of course, is L to the D. whereas S of omega is, of course, something that goes like d minus 1, L to the d minus 1. The other notion that we will be needing is the notion of a local Hamiltonian. So locality is very important, and I will define what I mean. And especially, it will be very important when we will be discussing the quantum case. So a local Hamiltonian is the sum of local operators. So, and in this case, by operator, so I am a little bit abusing the language because we're still in the classical case. So I don't mean that this is some Hermitian operator, but I just mean that there is some function of my degrees of freedom that has some local form. So what does it mean to have a local form? So our lattice, so if our lattice is gamma, so I will consider subsets of my lattice. Now, the subsets can be parameterized by a number r, and r is the diameter of this subset. So, for instance, if I have this subset, the diameter is 3. 1, 2, 3. So the diameter is simply the largest distance in terms of a graph distance that we can find in our subset. Okay, so this is, so any operator that acts on degrees of freedom that are inside this subset is a local operator, and that is parameterized by whose locality is parameterized by R. So, for instance, we have phi xr. So this is some function that is defined on these degrees of freedom. So, as a concrete example, so let me define, for instance, phi x1. So let's make some example. So imagine that our degrees of freedom are some variables that, as you know, are called Ising variables. So I is an index that is denoting the sites of my lattice. So it goes from 1 to large N, that is the total volume of my phase space. And these variables have values plus or minus 1. Okay? So x1 is one of these variables SI. So because this must be something that has diameter 1, so it must be just one point. So I will put I here because we have many of them. So for instance, a very simple function that we can associate to it is some constant HI times SI. Let's see something that has diameter 2. So this will be an object that I can define in this way, Si, Sj. Now, the I and j here are supposed to be nearest neighbors. Otherwise, we cannot make sense of the notion of diameter. So they are not I and j picked anywhere on the lattice, but they're nearest neighbors. Okay, so now that I've defined some local operators, I can define some Hamiltonian on this phase space that is simply the sum over all the I of my F x1 si plus the sum over all the, so this notation ij between these brackets means the edges of the lattice. So just the nearest neighbors, here, here, something like that. And we have fx2 ij. And this is nothing else but hi psi plus some ij jij psi sj. So you probably recognize this Hamiltonian. I'm sure you have done it in statistical mechanics. This is the Hamiltonian of the Ising model. And this in particular is the disordered Ising model. Disordered because, see, we have different couplings depending on the size of the system. So they are not constant. So the non-disordered Ising model instead is something like this. So, oh, sorry, si. So we have hi is equal h for every I. And usually we like to put a minus here. And we have also a common j. So this is our Ising model. Now, the Ising model is the most important model in statistical mechanics. And most modern statistical mechanics are somehow derived from the Ising model. So even though there are not many materials that are described by the Ising model, this is a very important one because it's the simplest model that contains all the basic ingredients to understand phase transitions, symmetry breaking, also quantum phase transitions when we go to the quantum case. And by understanding this, we will also understand what is needed to go beyond this paradigm. Okay. Okay. So we would like to understand what is a phase and therefore what is a phase transition. And so we know that a phase transition is something very dramatic that happens to our system. So typically this is mathematically described by the fact that the free energy has some non-analyticity for some value of either T, the temperature, or some value of the parameters lambda that define my Hamiltonian. So in my case, the parameters lambda are in the case of the Ising model, lambda 1 is H, lambda 2 is this J. So this non-analytic behavior of the free energy means that something dramatic happens to the system, and this will define the notion of phase transition and therefore of phase. So at this point, though, we have a question. So the question is the following. Okay, so look what is the free energy. So just this quantity multiplied by the logarithm of the partition function, okay? So it's the partition function that has to be non-analytic. But so what is this? So this is some number, right? So for instance, if we consider the Ising model, so we have some energies. So we have energies for all the possible configurations. So how many of these configurations do we have? Well, because every variable can take two values, so we have n such variables, we have 2 to the n configurations. So we have 2 to the n values of the energy. And therefore, the my z is nothing but so the sum over all the possible configurations. And this is a number that goes to 2 to the n. And then we have e to the minus beta e n. So now you see that this object is always analytic. Okay? So how is it possible that we can have some non-analyticity in the free energy or in the partition function? So do you have an idea? How can it happen? If for every n, this is analytic. Yes. Okay, so this is analytic insofar n is a finite number. But in the thermodynamic limit, that is when n goes to infinity, this is not assured. So we must understand what can happen. So what is the definition of the thermodynamic limit anyway? So that, the definition of thermodynamic limit is obtained by considering a density of a free energy. So the thermodynamic limit exists if exists this density, that is the limit for V going to infinity of F over V. And we would also like to have a surface density of free energy. So let me put an S here. So this is the limit for S going to infinity of F minus V small f over S. So these are two definitions. Let me pull this up. Okay. So in order to be able to do statistical mechanics, these two limits have to exist. So this is not always the case. So let me give you an example of systems that cannot be described in statistical mechanics, which means that simply the system with many particles is not stable. So the paradigmatic example is the charged system. So consider at zero temperature a system in three dimensions, a spherical system with a uniform charge density. And of course, we have a potential that is the Coulomb potential. Okay. So what is the free energy? Well, the free energy is E minus TS, but T is equal to zero. So we are considering the T equal zero case. So just the energy. So what is the energy of a system of radius R? Well, OK, so this is a simple exercise. And of course, this is, then there is some constant, rho squared R5. Well, OK, so let's see if we have our F in the thermodynamic limit. So we have to take the limit for the volume of the sphere going to infinity of this E of R over V. Well, so we can immediately see that this must go like R squared, right? Because the volume of the sphere is something like R cubed. OK, so you immediately see that for R very large, this is diverging. So a charged system does not admit the thermodynamic limit. So how come the matter is stable then, since it's a charged system? So the reason is that, so here I've only considered a charged systems where all the charges have the same sign. If you have plus or minus signs, the potential is not, the effective potential is not the Coulomb one anymore, but it is e to the minus r over some length called the bi-length. So forces are very, very short-ranged. And so the thermodynamic limit can exist. And in particular, so even if the thermodynamic limit exists, the system is unstable. So one of the reasons why quantum mechanics was born was to obtain the stability of the matter, and we need actually the Pauli exclusion principle in order to have a stable system. So this is for the charged system. If you consider an arbitrary potential, that is some power law, and in some arbitrary dimension D, and you do a similar calculation, so it's similar but not exactly the same calculation because we, in general, don't have the Gauss law. But so what we find is that in order for this integral to not diverge when we take the thermodynamic limit, it must be sigma larger than d. So we see that there is an interplay between the locality of our interactions, so how short range they are, and the dimensionality of the system. So we will see many times how the dimensionality of the system plays an important role in the statistical mechanics of the models that we will study. Okay, so now we have defined the thermodynamic limit. So now we will always consider the case in which the thermodynamic limit exists. And then we want to define what is a phase. So the phase is the domain of analyticity of F. Then we can have a singular loci so which are just subsets in the phase space where the free energy is not analytic. So for instance, imagine that we have some phase space and we have some parameters, lambda 1, lambda 2. So this could be a point where my free energy is not analytic. So this is a locus of dimensionality 1, sorry, 0. Or we could have a line, or we could have something that is bidimensional. So the loci of codimension 1 means d minus 1 of dimensionality d minus 1 are what define phase boundaries. So we will say, for instance, in a two-dimensional model, so let me this is a very notorious phase diagram. So it's the phase diagram of water. So this means that in this region, the free energy is analytic, in this region is analytic, in this region is analytic. And if we go from this point to this point, we must cross a point of non-analyticity. So this is a boundary between two different phases, and we say that we have a phase transition. So we immediately notice some ambiguities in this definition. So the first ambiguity is that here we can go from gas to liquid in two different ways. We could go in this way and then have a phase transition, or we could go in this way and do not have a phase transition. So the first thing that we must ensure in order to be talking about different phases is that there is no way of getting around some of these critical lines, like in this case. So we are forced to say that gas and liquid are the same phase, and only the solid is different from liquid and gas. Okay, so why liquid and gas are the same phase and they're different from the solid? So we know that the reason is that because they have the same symmetry, whereas, so in particular, they have all the possible spatial symmetries, whereas in a solid, as some crystalline structure and some spatial symmetry is broken, so they have different symmetries. So even in this way, we have some ambiguity, because what would happen if I could just add some new parameter to my Hamiltonian? So imagine that my Hamiltonian is initially something that is defined by these two parameters, and we add some perturbation that depends on some parameter lambda 3. And imagine that this parameter goes into some other axis. So in principle, it is always possible to add some parameter and then by moving in this direction, going from one phase to the other without crossing the phase transition, so we get, by adding a dimension, we can get around this line. So if this were the case, it would seem that there is only one phase. There are no different phases. So in order to deal with this ambiguity, we must always consider symmetry in a more precise way. We must always consider all the possible perturbations that have the same symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So this is our rule. We are allowed to add any perturbation that has the same symmetry of the Hamiltonian. So when two phases are distinct by symmetry, the only way to get around is to add a perturbation that breaks this symmetry. And so we have a consistent definition of a phase, because as long as we do not break the symmetry, we remain in the same symmetry domain. And this implies that to go from one to the other, we must encounter a phase transition. So the lesson is that if we allow any transformation of our Hamiltonian, any perturbation, then there is only one phase, it seems, if we disregard the symmetry. But if we only apply perturbations that do not change the symmetry of the Hamiltonian, then we can have really phase transitions. Okay, so what type of phase transitions do we have? So we have first order phase transitions and continuous phase transitions. First order phase transitions happen when this quantity is discontinuous. Whereas continuous phase transitions happen when there is some non-analyticity, but this quantity is continuous. So usually we are interested in continuous phase transitions. Let me just describe how a first order phase transition can happen. So the way first order phase transition can happen is the following. So first of all, we must be at t equals 0. So t equals 0 means that beta, my inverse temperature, is going to infinity. So if you look at the definition of the partition function, now we see that this is the other possibility in which Z can develop a non-analyticity. Even when the system is not in the thermodynamic limit, if beta goes to infinity, it is possible to have a non-analyticity in a Z. And actually, there is basically only one way in which this non-analyticity can happen. So let me plot the various energies of my system as a function of some parameter lambda. So we have some energies that change. And imagine that there is a value lambda c of lambda such that we have a level crossing. Well, now you see that what I call E1 is this line. So it means that in this point, df over d lambda, and well, in this case, at t equals 0, df is just dE over d lambda, must be discontinuous. So first order phase transitions correspond pretty much to level crossing. So they're not very interesting. Continuous phase transitions instead are richer and more interesting. Okay, so let's see what we can say about the Ising model, the phase transitions of the Ising model. So again, the Hamiltonian that we will consider is the one without the disorder. So is and F is this quantity. Okay, so we would like to know if there is a thermodynamic limit. So if this term Si as J is allowed to be taken with I and J at any distance, then this is not guaranteed. In fact, in order to have the thermodynamic limit, it must be that the sum over all the possible IJs, so let me put this back here in general, must be a real number. So again, this depends whether these couplings decay fast enough. But in this case, where they are just nearest neighbors, they decay, they're basically zero ranged. They have only a fixed range, and then they don't exist anymore. So the thermodynamic limit exists. So an important quantity is the average magnetization that is defined like 1 over n, the sum over all the magnetization of every single variable. And this is nothing else but 1 minus n df over dh, as it is immediate to verify. And now let's see what are the symmetry properties of the Ising model. Okay, so we have two symmetries. One is the Z2, sometimes called time reversal symmetry. And it says that the Hamiltonian for the parameter H, J, at some configuration, so the energy in some configuration of the spins and these parameters is equal to the energy that we obtain by changing the sign of the external magnetic field and changing the sign of all the spins in the given configuration. This also implies that the partition function for minus h and all the rest, j sigma I, is equal to the partition function of h. So this is easy to verify. The second symmetry is the sublattice symmetry. So what is the sublattice symmetry? So imagine that. So this is true in every hypercubic lattice. So you can see that we can bipartite this lattice because we can consider the white sides. Sorry. No, this is here, but this is not. And the orange sides. Now, the sublattice symmetry only exists for h equals 0. So this means that our energy is given only by this term. And now you see that this term only couples a site in the orange sublattice with a site in the white sublattice. So because of this, we obtain that the energy for some value of minus j of our coupling at some configuration of the spins in the sublattice A and the spins in the sublattice B is equal to the energy if we change the sign of our coupling and we change the sign in one of the two sublattices. And then the same with A exchange with B. So this is the second symmetry of the Ising model. The other thing that we notice is the following. So this energy is what we call a non-frustrated model. Non-frustrated model means that we can easily obtain the ground state energy, the minimum energy, by minimizing all the terms independently. So this is only true on a hypercubic lattice. So for instance, in a triangular lattice, if you write the same model in a triangular lattice, this is not possible. And this means that there is frustration. Okay. So consider the ground state. We see that for h greater than 0, the way of minimizing the energy is by putting all these variables equal plus 1. Whereas when h is smaller than 0, we minimize the energy by putting all these variables equal to minus 1. At h equals 0, there is a phase transition. And in fact, it's a first order phase transition. And there is a jump in the average magnetization from minus m to plus m. This is for the ground state energy. So this is what happens when the temperature is equal to 0. What happens at finite temperature? Let's see if I can. How do I erase this? So we would like to understand whether this phase transition survives at t greater than 0. So let's see what happens. So let's start with the one-dimensional case. So we've seen that one way of minimizing the energy is to obtain to have all the spins up. Means all the spins have the values plus 1. And we would like to understand what is the free energy in this case. Okay, so the entropy of this configuration is obviously 0, because there is only one way of obtaining this configuration. And therefore, the free energy is just the energy of the system, which is just minus nj. Okay. Now imagine that we change a little bit the configuration. So for instance, we could introduce two domains. And we would like to see whether these other configurations in which there are two domains is more or less stable. Well, the energy, so let me call this energy here E0, because it's the ground state energy. So the new energy is, well, so you see each of these pairs still minimizes our Hamiltonian, but, and also each of these pairs, but here, we are violating the condition Si Sj. So this means that our energy is E0 plus 2j. OK, so the energy didn't change much. And now let's see the entropy. So what is the entropy of this type of configurations? Well, because we can put this domain anywhere in our one-dimensional system, there are n ways of putting it. So S is equal k log n. So the difference in free energy between the configuration with one domain wall and no walls is therefore 2j minus kt log n. So you see that in the thermodynamic limit, so when this number is very large, we always lower the free energy by introducing a domain wall. So this argument can be repeated, and we can introduce more and more walls, and we always gain, diminish our free energy, because actually the more walls we put, the more our entropy will increase. So the one that really minimizes the free energy is the one in which there are so many walls that there are no domains anymore. So if there are no domains, the net magnetization must be always zero. So if it is always zero for every value of the temperature, then as long as the temperature is greater than zero, because otherwise we don't have the entropy contribution at all. So if it is always zero, there cannot be any phase transition, because we do not have this passage from m greater than zero to m smaller than zero. So we see that in one dimension, there are no phase transitions at a finite temperature. Let's see what happens instead in 2D. And let's try to see the same argument again. Okay, so now our system is two-dimensional, right? And now, so imagine that all the spins are plus, so it's plus everywhere. But now we want to create a cluster of spins that is minus. And we would like to see whether we lower the free energy by creating many clusters like this. So what happens to the free energy in this case? So imagine that this cluster has a perimeter that is small n. So now my energy is A0 plus 2nj. How, and what is the entropy? So this is my energy. So the entropy is the number of ways in which I can create a bubble like this with the perimeter n. And this number is some exponential in n. So in particular, mu is the degree of our lattice. So the reason is that if this is a regular lattice, so we are counting how many ways there are of changing this boundary by keeping the perimeter fixed. And there is a finite number of ways in which we can change the perimeter per unit of length. And this finite number depends on how many moves we can make on a lattice. So for instance, in a square lattice is 4. So it's some number. So actually, this is an approximation, but it is quite valid. Actually, in this way, we are overestimating the entropy. The real entropy is slightly smaller than this one. Well, so this means that our change in the free energy, which is delta E minus T delta S, and of course there is a log here. Well, you see that is equal to 2J minus KT log mu times N. Okay, now you see that both these terms, so the energy term and the entropic term, are both scaling with N. So whereas in 1D, it is only the entropic term that is scaling with N. Therefore, when N is large and we go to the thermodynamic limit, no matter how small is T, the entropy will always win. So we will always diminish the free energy by creating more domains. Now it depends whether this number is positive or negative. So we have a critical temperature that is equal to two J over K log M log mu. And depending whether, so when Tc is greater than this number, then the entropy will prevail. Otherwise, the energy will prevail, which means that we do not like, the system does not get more stable by creating bubbles like this. So it will stay, it will prefer to stay with the net magnetization that is M. So now we see that this depends pretty much on the initial conditions. If the system started with a net positive magnetization below the critical temperature, it will stay there. And for how long it will stay there? It will stay there for a time that is the exponential of this free energy barrier. So this is the exponential of a number that is like n, and then is scaling to the entire size of the system. If instead we started from a negative net magnetization, it will be trapped there for a time that scales in this way. So in the thermodynamic limit, the system will not explore the whole phase space, but it will be trapped in one of the two regions in the phase space for an arbitrarily long time. So this is what happens, what is called ergodicity breaking. And this is the reason why if we compute the net magnetization, depending on the initial conditions, we would find that M, instead of being zero, is either greater than zero or smaller than zero. So for instance, if we have here the temperature and here the magnetization, there is a Tc above which, so as we were saying, above the critical temperature, the entropy will always win. So this means that we will always like to create all the walls that we want, as so many that there is no domain anymore, and therefore the net magnetization is zero. But below Tc, the net magnetization becomes greater than zero and goes actually in this way. So in this case, I'm considering the case in which there was an initial net magnetization that was positive. Otherwise, I would have something like this. So next time, we will see how this is obtained. It's called the method of sources. So what one does is to compute this quantity by adding a small term. Actually, this term with the sign that breaks the symmetry between all spins up and all spins down, then taking the thermodynamic limit and then sending this term to zero. But at that point, this has determined basically initial conditions such that we cannot revert to the system, meaning that we cannot create these domains. So next time we'll see that in details. And so the two phase, the two possibilities that now are separated in two different sectors of the phase space are related by symmetry. Because, so in one case, we have a net positive magnetization, the other one, a negative magnetization. If we flip all the spins, meaning if we do this operation here from all the SI, we go to minus SI, we go from one configuration to the other. So they are related by symmetry, but each of them breaks the initial symmetry of our Hamiltonian. So we have seen that symmetry breaking is accompanied by ergodicity breaking. So the symmetry breaking is a generic mechanism to obtain ergodicity breaking. And it means that the system stay, when breaks the symmetry, can stay trapped there for an arbitrarily long time. This has implications in also in information theory, because this is the generic mechanism with which you create a memory register. So memory register is a way of encoding one bit of information. So for instance, our bit is 0 if the magnetization is greater than 0 and 1 if it's smaller than 0, but it must be robust. So we do not want our memory to have a lifetime that is short. In fact, we want it to stay there forever. And this number, when we consider realistic systems that have 10 to the 23 particles, is pretty much forever. So symmetry breaking always produces ergodicity breaking. The question that we should ask is if this is true, the contrary. So does it also go the other way around? Is every way of trapping the system in some metastable state obtained by breaking the symmetry? So this is the question that we'll answer tomorrow. Thank you. So are there any questions?
So you mentioned that if you have 10 to the 23 particles, what's the usual then lifetime of this state for it?
So the real lifetime then depends on the actual constants that you put in the system. Mm-hmm. And this is not very important. The important thing is the scaling, how you can make it scale.
So I was just wondering, what was the usual numbers? Would it be something like...
So the usual number can be the age of the universe. So for systems with an Avogadro number of particles, easy. This is as long as you are below TC. The moment you go above TC, immediately you lose.
So, on the same note, for instance, if you have a permanent magnet, they demagnetize with time. So, does that mean that they do not have that?
So, they demagnetize with time for several reasons. So, first of all, they're not described by the Essen model. So the Essen model describes only some particular alloys that are quite rare. So usually, I mean, real magnetization is doesn't have only two values, you know, up and down, but it is a continuous group. It is all three. So actually, the ordering of a continuous symmetry is more delicate. Moreover, what happens usually is that the sample has disorder. So whatever are your couplings, they depend on these numbers I, j. So this also changes the picture, and you obtain a different scaling for the lifetimes. The third reason is that there can be fluctuations in temperature. So even if, it doesn't count only the average temperature, but also what are the fluctuations that also can destroy. Other questions? Okay, let's see more.